Welcome to the World of Horror podcast, It Means the World of Horror to Me edition. I'm Mom, aka Christina.
And I'm Mac.
And this is the podcast where we invite guests on to discuss their favorite, or fond of, horror movies. This week, Tim and Ryan from the phenomenal podcast Dismembering Horror are with us to discuss movies that mean the world of horror to them. Welcome, fellas!
Hello.
Hello, Christina and Mac. Hello, whoa-hoes.
They'll be so excited.
They will really be on their toes. Can you tell our wohos a little bit about yourselves and about your podcast?
I can talk about our podcast. Ryan and I have known each other for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or something like that at this point. And I had been throwing around the idea of doing some sort of movie review podcast and decided I wanted to lean into the horror side of it. And it just so happened that Ryan's friend, who was your friend who suggested it?
He was our guest, as we called him, Dr. Andy Williams,
right.
My friend Andy.
Yeah. He had been sort of suggesting similar things to Ryan, and we were at a party or something, and we started talking about it and ended up meeting up and decided to move forward and do a pretty strict horror podcast. So that's sort of where it all originated from. And, you know, we cover pretty much the gamut of horror films, anything from super obscure to like new releases and such, streaming things as well. And we have three sections where we talk about what worked in the film, what didn't work, and then things of note. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And I think we have that format because we found it helps to, Tim and I are both filmmakers with an emphasis, either intentionally or not, in genre, including
yeah.
horror. So we find that format helps or sort of break things down from an educational standpoint, where from those specific things, what worked, what did not, things of note, we can delve plenty deep in there and dismember him well, as we call it with our show, Dismembering Horror.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, what worked for you drop come from? Because it really is an earworm for me. It gets stuck in my head.
That was all what I will gladly call an inspired recording session between Tim and myself. Where for each of those inner titles for our show, we kind of had an idea of what we needed. And like Tim's an actor and I can summon things when I need them to. So we just knew what we needed. We knew like ghostly, ethereal, like kid voice. So that's just me like sped up slightly or like with the pitch heightened slightly.
Yeah.
And just Tim and I just kind of like making each other laugh until we got those takes, which didn't take long. Thanks for, I'm glad you liked that. Good to hear.
Yeah, it's very effective. Well, I'm also really excited to get to talk to you guys during spooky season this year. And I was wondering if there is any movie or any movies that you watch particularly at this time of year.
Every year.
Mm. Every year.
I tend to watch The Shining every Halloween season.
Yeah, I can't say there's an every year thing for me because I think I always have to have like the occasional breather year. But to that effect, recent one, no, it's a guilty pleasure. I don't really have guilty pleasures, but I liked Hubie Halloween. I've watched that both couple Halloweens. Marathoning the Psychos. I love doing that. Mm-hmm. Ernest Scared Stupid is classic. And then what we're talking about today, Carnival of Souls, I found myself coming back to as well.
I've heard really good things about Hubie's Halloween. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it, Mac?
I'm not going to lie. I couldn't really get through it. I got halfway in. And then I was like, you know what? I think I'm good.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I have this weird fascination with like the terrible Adam Sandler comedies. So I don't know.
My boyfriend does as well. Like he showed me like Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison and both of them, he was like really funny, right? And I was like, I'm sorry. I don't think I have the gene to enjoy this.
Yeah, I can't profess they're actually really funny. It's just, as I said, weird fascination. Anyway.
I think if they hit you right, then, you know, maybe they hit you at a specific time, then you're like endlessly, because he's the same way. Like he was like, let's watch Hubie Halloween. It's going to be really funny.
Well, give Little Nicky a shot.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Meaning 10 minutes before you turn it off.
Max, do you have a movie that you watch every year?
Honestly, it might be Alien. I might have already gotten it clocked in because a few years ago, I played Alien Isolation during Halloween for the first time. And well, first and only time. I mean, I beat the game, but I won't be playing it again because it scared the shit out of me. I had already loved Halloween, but it gave me another appreciation for it because they perfectly just got the whole design of the Nostromo right in that game. And so now I always love watching Alien again and like looking at all the details, or even like when the android guy is like running, that's a thing they put in the game, all that stuff. So I nerd out over Alien every year, I think.
I have a new favorite. We Are Still Here, which I don't know. I think I'm that film's biggest fan, but I really like that film a lot. So
I can picture the poster. I know it's on my watch list.
Yeah, it's great. I mean,
great. I'll watch it.
Really fantastic finale. So just hang. The acting's a little uneven, but I want to tell you guys that I found your podcast when I was looking up information on Kuroneko, and I've been hooked ever since. And I went back 4 years, and I've just allowed myself to listen to those episodes where I've seen the movie that you guys talk about. So I'm still going to have a lot to catch up on, which is very exciting. I love your podcast so much.
Thanks.
And I also wanted to just say thank you so much for your conversation during the Changeling episode when you guys were sort of talking about people you had lost recently. That was very affecting to me. And just talking about how horror, maybe in a strange way, can help us to cope with the tough subjects of death and all those things that we fear in life.
I do think that there is something specific about horror that allows us to look into that in a sort of in a quote unquote safe way, because generally we're pretty safe when we're watching a movie, even though it's evocative, but it is important. It's like it allows us to see into this space that I think culturally we tend to avoid in a lot of ways. So even though horror, I think, gets kind of a bad rap for a lot of people as just like gratuitous or something, it tends, I mean, even in the ones that we watch that we don't particularly like as, you know, film viewers, it still is like touching on those things a lot of the time. So I find that like we almost never say avoid a movie because there's always some sort of value that we find in it. I mean, once in a while, sure, but
yeah,
pretty rarely.
Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly to your point. I was going to say The Changeling, neither of us really loved it.
No.
But does not mean we can't, don't have a lot of things to say about what comes up when watching it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to think of movies that you've done a straight avoid. Have you both agreed on an avoid yet?
I mean, yeah, we're closing in on episode 200, and you know how horror movies can be. it's part of the fun. But The Girl Next Door comes to mind.
Yeah.
I think, oh, like, man.
2007.
I couldn't finish that book. I tried to read it twice.
Oh, that's interesting.
Huh. Okay.
So even the book doesn't.
Oh, the book is probably way worse. Like, and
oh, no.
When I read the reviews for the book, they were like, listen, if you got halfway through and you can't get through it, don't get through it because it only gets worse. Like, it only keeps getting worse.
The movie is rough.
Can you think of any other ones?
Did we both say avoid to The Last Key?
Insidious, The Last Key. That might have been early enough.
We didn't have a rating system yet. That's right. I feel like I would have said
avoid. I think we might have both been avoid with that one.
We were pretty mad about it.
Yeah, sorry to, like, yeah, all the, I don't know.
People love those movies. It's fine. It's just, it wasn't for us.
Right. I know. I'm a weird hit or miss with the kind of the Blumhouse horror brand, the Nuns, Conjurings, and all those.
There's a lot of misses.
Yeah, but respect to them too, and their fans. I get it at the same time.
I think we both said avoid to what was it called? It's the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, Maggie. That was really bad. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, hard to get
I don't think
through.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a zombie movie with Abigail Breslin and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Wasn't she in Zombieland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So,
yeah, this is it's not like an Arnold Schwarzenegger horror comedy kind of fun action thing. It's like a very somber looking as well. Yeah, where his Abigail Breslin, his daughter, is like turning into a zombie slowly. So Arnold's sad and coping with it. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Not to accentuate the negative here, but yeah, those are a couple that come to mind.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about in terms of rating a movie, what do you guys think about when you can tell the movie's good, it's just not for you? Like, how do you rate it in a case like that?
I feel like I almost always in those cases say it's worth renting. You know, with our structure, we say the highest praise being you would buy the film and like put it on your shelf. And then next would be rent, after that stream, like you're not really spending money on it, and then avoid. And I think that almost universally for me, when I think that there's merit in the film, but it's just not my thing, I think I almost always say rent it, because it's like, it's worth putting some money down for somebody, like for, you know, just to get some value out of it, even though it's not for me. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And when we give those ratings, we always try to, I mean, with our show overall too, always try to stress how subjective everything is. So we'll say, like, if you are talking to yourself, Tim, would you tell yourself to avoid stream rent or buy this film? But I'd say that, yeah, rent. I can say I've been going through that with the Giallo films are kind of a recurring thing like that for me, where I get it, and I think I'm getting them more and more over time, that it's about that they're hard to follow and the plotting's not important at all, and it's all about the dreaminess and maybe the fact that they seem like they're long and can't follow anything is part of that all. So I always like tip my hat to those in that way, with the rent often, but it's an example of not always going to be on my personal favorites, but I'm trying. Yeah, I'm trying. Inferno was really good.
I
liked Inferno.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that came up on the Criterion. They have like their 80s horror this month. So I think that's in my playlist.
Oh yeah, that's where I watched it.
But yeah, we did Suspiria on the show and we were both like, it's good. But we don't really feel a connection to it.
I wanna watch it with someone who loves it. Like, I want that experience, but when by myself I was watching it, I was like, I have so many moments like this because I have a lot of people I talk to who also love horror movies, and some of those people love that movie. And so I just kept thinking, like, what are they seeing? What are they seeing? And I just simply did not see it. But at the same time, like you said, I was like, listen, I trust them. I know that this is good for a lot of people. I wish I knew why. Like, I would rather enjoy something every time than not like it.
Yeah. Well, catch a repertory screening if you can. Okay. What sort of helped me with the Giallo, there's an episode of The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs where Eli Roth comes on. I think they talk about, is it like the House at the Cemetery, something like that, is the episode? I don't know. You'll find it. It's one of the ones in the recent season with Eli Roth. And he just gives a great spiel and sell and kind of gives you an in and lens to watch Giallo films with. So I recommend that. And then the standout one that Tim and I both gave buy-ins to was Opera. Like, we both really, really loved Opera.
Yeah. It's okay. Quite something.
Have you guys ever changed your mind in hindsight about a movie that you reviewed on the podcast?
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, that happens fairly often. I feel like, didn't you when you saw Midsommar the first time, you were sort of like reticent about
we notoriously both gave Midsommar a rent after our first viewing. And it was just because it's like so just overwhelming and different. You just don't know what to think of it. We're sure to stress that and like often stress that, where I think like the best of movies often you can't like, they're good because you can't really wrap your mind and soul around it on a first viewing. They inception you, and that takes some time. So now it's, I think this is one of the greatest movies.
I know. I mean, it's crazy to think that we walked out of that being like, I don't know.
Yeah. I was distracted. I remember sometimes the theater going experience can, you know, affect it too. But then, so there's that. Yeah. Those were what happens, like the really great ones that this sort of take a couple viewings or whatever, or just thinking about it, sinking. And then there are the ones where I think just the fun of the viewing experience, like makes the good rise to the top, where like, I mean, Dolly Dearest felt like nothing special that we watched. But like, I ended up buying it just because I remember I had so much fun watching it with Tim. And same with like The Stuff. That's another one that I was probably, I think, a rented at first, but then ended up buying just because it was just remember the feel and the fun of watching it and really growing to love Larry Cohen at the same time. So I'm like, yeah, The Stuff. Yeah, it's great.
There's a number of times where at the beginning of us starting our conversation about a film, I've had kind of one opinion. And by the end of our conversation, I've kind of said, you know what, this movie's actually got more to it now that we've had a chance to talk about those things. And it changes my total perspective of it. So it happens, not super often, but it definitely happens.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's sort of the whole premise of our show, is that like we wanted a place where we could have those conversations after seeing a horror film that allow you to kind of get a little deeper insight into like what was going on, what was your experience, and like to be able to have that conversation with a like-minded horror person is, you know, kind of the point.
Yeah, that usually happens with Mac, where I'll like a movie a whole lot, and then after we talk about it, I don't like it as much.
I was about to say, I think I give my mom the opposite effect of y'all, is like, we'll be talking about something, and then I hear like 30 minutes later, like, I don't think I like this as much anymore. Because I'm very good at finding the negative. I don't know. I try to be a positive person, but sometimes just like, but what about this? Didn't this annoy you?
Yeah. Stuff you may have overlooked. Yeah.
That definitely happened with Lake Bodum. I really liked it when we went into the conversation. And then I just like my opinion just kept dropping as we talked more about it.
The great pessimist.
But I think the opposite just recently happened, Mac, but it's slipping my memory, like, you know, what that movie was. But actually, you helped me to like something.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it isn't like an, you know, one directional thing. But
yeah. Enthusiasm's contagious either way, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. You mentioned that you were filmmakers, and Mac and I watched your short film, Ryan, Forest Falls.
Great.
And
thank you.
I just wanted to say that you had me at Millipede. Like, as soon as that little guy showed up, I was like, you know, because I have a terrible fear of millipedes. Like, it's pathological. But
I'll be sure to tell our millipede wrangler it was all worth it.
Give him a bonus.
But
the timer scene was incredible. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like probably as maybe you've experienced of if you watch a lot of horror movies, like there are just certain things that, you know, just don't affect me as much anymore. Like a good jump scare that I really don't expect, like, will get me to be like, oh God, but you know, won't really like make fear settle in. But I could really feel myself be like, oh my God, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Which does not always happen when I watch a movie. So
great.
I was like, I got to tell them that.
All right. Great to hear. Awesome. That's Forest Falls. Everyone listening, available on YouTube. Yeah, no, thanks for watching. That means a lot.
Oh yeah. It's really great. Do you guys have a favorite slasher film?
Oh man.
Favorite of the big franchises, just premise wise, is Nightmare on Elm Street for me. And then different and then next ranking, like a close second, Friday the 13th series, like with 3 and 4 hitting the sweet spot. And then Halloween last, but I still love it. And then as far as like the offshoot ones, I love it when there's that little bit of like the killer has a supernatural tinge to it. So like we both had a blast watching Jack Frost last Christmas. I loved that. And Prom Night 2, Hello Mary Lou, I had a kick with that too. So those are all coming to mind. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I probably am pretty traditional. Like the first and second Friday the 13th stick out. I never really loved Nightmare on Elm Street stuff, but the Halloweens I was all about. So maybe it's something about the stoic killer slasher versus the goofy
sort of goofball,
dad joke. One.
I was going to say, I love Nightmare on Elm Street, but not because it scares me, because it's so camp.
I just like the possibility that where the kills can go just based off the premise, how creative they can. That's what sells it for me.
I saw like when I was a kid, my brother and I were watching like VH1 or something, and they were doing I Love the 80s, and they were just talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, but I was like a prepubescent child, like had no idea. And it scared me so bad. And I feel like that residual fear just from watching that one, like they showed the scene where like Johnny Depp dies, and they showed a few other just here or there. And I remember that night, because I think my brother was like, we were away, parents were away for the weekend, and I like could not sleep. And so then he lied to me, and he was like, well, how they got Freddy is they got a dream catcher and they threw it in the trash. So he died, and I had a dream catcher. So I threw it away, and I was like, nice, I'm good. Wow. very smart of him.
That's a good get to know you question. Do you each have a favorite slasher film?
It's really not my favorite genre. Like, I don't know why, it just doesn't get me as much as other things. But I guess like out of the classics, like Nightmare on Elm Street. And also I really like the show Slasher, that's on Netflix and Shudder. So maybe that gets an honorable mention.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Oh yeah, you definitely should. Should he start with like 4 or...
Start with 2.
2.
The first season is absolute garbage, but it's like an anthology, so every season's different. But I will say the writing, not good. The acting, not very good. But the kills are incredible, and they actually do like practical effects, and they get so creative with it.
Nice. They maybe sort of watched the first episode of the first season, and was like, no.
Yeah, it's like I tried – I watched the second season first, and I was like, well, let me just give the first one a shot. And I watched the whole thing. And that's like the thing I owe. I try to spread the word of Slasher as much as I can, but I'm always like, please, please do not watch the first season.
Is it Adam McDonald who did Backcountry Mac? I don't remember. Oh, I think he's the director of the last season, and he did Backcountry, the Canadian Bear.
Yeah.
I think I'm a Freddy girl too, just because I was sort of, that was the first one that I saw. Well, Halloween might've been the first one that I saw. I wasn't supposed to see it. When I was sort of watching movies on my own, I really got into the Nightmare series. So that's probably my favorite.
Great.
Do y'all have a favorite genre though? If you had, cause there's a lot of horror subgenres.
Subgenre. Yeah. That's tough. Yeah.
Well, you don't have to pick a favorite. Maybe just like ones that you really like.
I do love it all. Yeah. I love a good Asian horror movie for sure. And I'm always seeking out new ones of those. They're kind of few and far between, but whenever we get a good one of those, I get really excited.
I've come to realize that I think that it's the body horror elements, but I tend to like, surprisingly, because I don't feel like I talk about this a ton, but like I'm going to talk about Alien. My other possible choice was The Thing, and I was like, these are, they're the same genre essentially, right? Like trapped in an isolated place with a foreign alien-esque, you know, monster. And I think that for me, it's sort of quote unquote, this like monster in the house, but the body horror component that alien stuff brings, I think is really like the wheelhouse that I tend to love.
Sci-fi body horror trapped in a location.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I think, yeah, that my answer was specifically to like, just trying to answer, you know, subgenre, but as far as how to classify what my favorites are, I would have to not speak in terms of genre.
Go for it.
So that can be part of though our Carnival of Souls talk. So maybe I should save it.
Why don't we get into it, Tim? Are you ready to talk about aliens?
Sure.
All right. I just want to let the Wohos know, fair warning, per usual, our discussions will include spoilers and probably language which may not be appropriate for all listeners. I just copied the IMDb plot. Sometimes we like to talk about whether or not this is accurate, but it just says the crew of a commercial spacecraft encounter a deadly life form after investigating an unknown transmission.
That is true.
Yes. The next sentence I think would be on the secret plan, how it was all there from the get-go. To get this alien.
That's
and
right.
To keep it secret from the truckers, if you want to call them that.
That's right, space truckers.
Yeah.
Tim, what's your history with this film?
Okay, that's a great question. My history. So my, I've mentioned this on the show a number of times. I have an older brother. He's 4 years older, and he would essentially dupe my mom into allowing me to watch horror films that I was way too young for. So Alien actually was one of the first movies that he kind of introduced me to before I was able to watch it. So he had watched it with his friends and then explained to me what the movie was, like, in great detail. He then went and saw Aliens in the theater and came back and gave me literally note for note exactly the whole movie. So like that was my introduction to it. And so as soon as I kind of could, I got my hands on them and consumed them and then got into the franchise. And I think I was like maybe a junior or senior in high school when the third one came out. So the whole franchise I've been, you know, into pretty much since I was like 8 or 9 or something like that. But what I've found is that the first one is the one that I regularly go back to. I would probably say around every 3 or 4 months. Part of that is just the tone of it is so eerie and so kind of captivating. The whole first half of the film is this slow roll into, you know, doom that for some reason, I don't know, it's Ridley Scott's wheelhouse, I guess, is just this crawling, like horror, I guess, you know, for lack of a better term. And the simplicity of it all is, I think, what also gets me. And then to, you know, continue on what Ryan was saying, there's a lot of layered sort of social commentary throughout the film that I'm fond of. I think that's one of the big reasons I gravitate towards horror so much is like when you can ostensibly be giving these sort of, you know, fantastical stories, but have them layered with this deeper meaning of things that we deal with on a personal level or a societal level all the time like that. Makes each viewing continually sort of evocative for me. So, I mean, you know, I probably have watched it, I don't know, 50 times, something like something crazy. And every time I watch it, I'm picking up new little, you know, details. So it's just one of those films that does that for me. There's not a ton of them that I revisit as often as I do this one. So top of the list for sure.
When we were talking about very specific descriptions for genres, for me, one must be sci-fi or sci-fi horror talking about capitalism. Like, I think something. Exactly. There's any movie where that happens, I'm like, I like this.
Yeah. I don't know why sci-fi works so well with that kind of commentary. Maybe it's something about the bleakness of space. I don't know. It's like you can quickly compare that to the bleakness of capitalism. I don't know, something like that.
Well, to put a context slightly askew to how we know it immediately makes it critique or something. That's when we latch on to it. So just that it's truckers in space, we, I don't know, get that sense of whatever commentary is inherent. Yeah.
Yeah. And they really nail it. Like, the first 10 minutes of the film are essentially the two low men on the totem pole being like, are we going to get more money? Like, can we get more money? This is bullshit. Like, why aren't we getting paid what everybody else is getting paid? And, you know, Tom Skerritt's character pretty bleakly says, hey, like, your contract's a contract. You get nothing or you do the job. Mm-hmm. And that alone is just like, we're all like, oh yeah, I know that feeling.
And I feel like kind of what you said, Ryan, is so true about giving us something to latch onto. Cause I mean, I've never been a trucker, but I worked in like a greenhouse like situation, and how, you know, the two guys that y'all are talking about, like working, more with the machinery, it just was so accurate to me. And I feel like this movie has such good like character building without feeling like cheesy or like nobody ever says something where you're like, oh, that's just plot exposition. I feel like everything, I don't know, really just feels like people just like us, but in space.
Yeah. That to me is like it's really the strength of it. It's like we get to see these people being very human, very sort of just raw, normal, like relatable people. And each character obviously kind of fits so almost eloquently into or elegantly into these archetypes that we know so well, right? Like Ripley's whole character is really kind of screwed. Like she's so caught in between the notion of doing what's right, like doing the protocol for the sake of the greater good, versus the interpersonal like conflict that comes with like opinion and having your superiors basically override the what's best for the greater good is such a universally felt thing, right? We feel this all the time where you're like, yeah, I get that you have this opinion and you have this emotional need, but like at what cost? And then we get to watch the whole movie unfold and have her be like, I mean, it's one big, I told you so, really. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, and I think importantly, and this is sort of famously known, that the script was originally written as Ripley as a male character, and they ended up switching that around. And the implication that you get out of having her character not be just a Tom Cruise or something, it makes such a big difference in how the film is received. So it really just, I think it's one of those movies where all of these things coalesce to be, I mean, arguably a perfect film. I don't know. I could probably feel confident making that argument.
Yeah. I mean, you got me thinking, like when you said how they're archetypes in a way, and I don't know, what this film pulls off for me, that is just the thing I look for in movies so much as far as a mark of how good they are. We're like, yeah, think in terms of archetypes and characters. It always feels like, yeah, when you're making films or I guess critiquing them, that it feels like it always feels like there's this risk that to pursue those things when you feel like you're going to run into making caricature somehow right. so easily. But yeah, I'm so amazed at, no, these sort of, you know, tenets and filmmaking and character building, they really do work for bringing across that realism, even though it feels like sometimes that approach in doing these sort of more, yeah, by the book things, you know, in the end they make it more realistic. And I don't know. And that's sort of in the filmmaking sense too, outside of, the acting and the character work, this film just does that too, where, like you said, like simplicity is always, you think of with this film. And like, it's easy to think of, especially when you're kind of comparing it to Aliens, that this film's like static or slow or kind of simple in that regard. But really, like when you watch it more carefully as it goes, the simplicity, it doesn't, it only means those things when those are applicable to the scene. Because like, as we go on, there's just some incredible directorial touches to it where it's like, for example, there's when Ripley's climbing up a ladder to the next floor, you could totally play it as like the wide shot that happens where she comes out and she's holding the gun. But it's this iconic shot that starts the moment where her fingers come down. They look a little bent. They're like extreme close up. And then her face comes up just above it. Like, that's the kind of thing I could imagine making it and being like, oh, this feels so forced and like, it's so obvious, it's this beat. But no, you just think in terms of, okay, it's in the script. Like, how is she feeling right now? That's what we want to plug into. It's just covering this beat, and it's a simple way to do it. But yeah, it'd be easy. Maybe this is from the filmmaker's perspective of like, okay, well, no, it's more realistic to just cover it in the wide. But no, actually, it's really doing the simple thing to have this close up, which could feel too stylistic. And you see that too with like, there's a great shot when Ian Holmes attacks and it's like tracks with her as she's crawling away on the ground. So it's like a really high energy shot to have that's creative. Or like the shot in the same moment where he attacks her, she's kind of out of it for a sec and the camera kind of goes around him until he hears the sound of like a wind chime thing. Yeah, but then you sort of see what that's doing for in simple storytelling ways at the same time. But it's so easy then afterwards, the memory of the film just being this like, just static or simple in a bad way.
And I like that. I mean, I don't want to like rag on Aliens, but when you brought up Aliens, I feel like, again, watching it made me love Aliens so much more because it just felt like, I mean, even in simple ways of the fact that there's no romantic like attachments, you know, that we can have a female character who's just getting like shit done, you know, and that there's, and they are like a crew, like this is a crew and they're just doing a job. So there's no need to have any sort of romantic tension. And so I watched Alien over again with some friends, and then we watched Aliens right after, and we just kept groaning because we were like, what is this like compulsory heterosexuality they're doing with like Ripley? And I feel like on the flip side, they do have the caricatures in Aliens where you see characters and you're like, okay, I know what your deal is. You know, I get what they're going for.
I did realize this last time watching it. It's still what that often does when you have that forced subplot or whatever, it just lends some humanity to the characters. And I think that for too long has been just kind of like a given or whatever. But you see, I realize what this film Alien does that is maybe it's because I'm like, I have a cat, but when she's really going for the cat Jones and like has to save him at the end and they have some really tender moments together, you're rooting for them as a couple, quote unquote, or it's doing that same thing, you know, in a way.
As a cat lover, like, I would go back.
Yeah.
I totally would. And I love that you said that because I think you're so right. It makes me like love Ripley. I already was enjoying her, but that I was like, yeah, you do have to go back for Josie.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about saving the cat in terms of making a character sympathetic. I guess there's a book called Save the Cat, that has that as a premise. And I know that in Bob Odenkirk's like action film, he saves a kitten. So what's the deal with saving a cat? Does it just make a person more lovable?
Yeah, there's a, I guess, a philosophy or theory, I guess. Who was it? Blake Snyder? He did Save the Cat. The idea that, I don't know if this is quantifiably true, but the idea is that if you have a character, you can kind of have them do anything. They can be a despicable person. But if in the first act, typically, you have them do something that's very, very human kindness oriented, that we almost infer that we are okay with them, that like we're on board with them as a character, even if they're doing terrible things, or if they're just a jerk, if they help a lady across the street, or if they take a little bit of just a moment of time to acknowledge somebody or something that is, what would be a good word? Like, not in trouble, but in need, I guess, that just has a super deep impact on us subconsciously. And we just get on board with them. And they can do really, like, I always think of Children of Men. Like, Clive Owen is not a very, like, likable person in that movie at all. But he does something in the very early beats of the movie. I can't remember if it's in the coffee shop or something like that, where we're like, yeah, he seems like kind of a prick, but you know, he like held the door for that person, so he can't be that bad, or whatever it is. And so, yeah, it's just a device that, you know, I'm sure many people have used over the years or come up with just to see if it works, and it seems to be working fine. So now it's become almost a joke, right? Like, I think, is it the Bob Odenkirk film is called Nobody?
Yeah,
I think that in that movie, it feels like, like they're tipping their hat and saying, like, we know that this is a dorky example of that, but we're going to do it anyway.
It's the title of the book. Yeah.
Right.
But can also be used, same idea as famously a twist, a revealing twist in the form of Rosebud at the end of Citizen Kane. So
that's right. Yeah.
That's funny. It sounds like you had that question lined up. It's funny that I specifically mentioned Saving Jonesy.
Well, no, it's been, there's a podcast I listen to that I love called Kill the Cat, and they're filmmakers. And so I didn't know about this idea. And so I'm sort of on the lookout now for cats being saved.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I just think, you know, to kind of encapsulate why I love the movie so much, in horror, I think a lot of cases, the third act feels like it can fall apart, and often is the kind of like the most disappointing aspect of a horror film. I don't necessarily know why that tends to be the case. Maybe not always. I mean, certainly not always, but like in a lot of horror films that seem like the premise is really strong and that like they've got a grasp on it, and the first couple acts are really like nailing whatever that thing is, it just doesn't come together in the third act. Alien is like the perfect example of the build into the third act, and then like masterful third act structure. Because once Ripley is on her own, effectively, I mean, even just before that, with the last two kills happening as they're trying to get the fuel to get out of there, the moments of suspense building that you get having her get to the escape ship, whatever you call it, the life raft, so to speak, being confronted with the alien, being in the way, having to go back and get Jones, having to shut off the self-destruct and then go turn it back on. Like all of these things, having it not work when she gets there, like these are just the most perfect stacking of suspense. Like, so nothing about that third act moves in a sort of in it's the perfect mirror to the beginning. Like there's this slow dread of the beginning that feels like it's stretching time. And the third act does the exact opposite. It compresses time into like this frenetic, like, oh, we're totally screwed. Like we do not have enough time. And putting that, you know, the ticking time bomb, so to speak, on, and then being, you know, having to be faced with these hurdles to get through it is perfect filmmaking. Then once we like the movement out of that intense suspense and into presumed safety, to have there then be an added conflict, you know, the actual final conflict in this smaller, the smallest of spaces, right, is sort of the whole deal. So just like Dan O'Bannon, the writer, and Ridley Scott obviously understood so clearly how to construct that type of suspense building and movement into really just surprise after surprise. Because when we see the alien's head come out of the sort of the wall in this sort of camouflaged way, every time you watch the movie after that, you're looking for it, and it's still disguised really, really well. And so it's just all of the above things lead me to this conclusion. Like it's nothing about the movie fails. So yeah, it's great. Go watch it a million times.
Yeah. The only new observation I had watching it this time was just when something is so well done, I guess a sort of measure of that is when things that can feel maybe anachronistic in the filmmaking only still work for the better, but in like an entirely new way, like how film solidifies into itself as it gets older is a way that I think about it, where that technology of the kinds of screens they're using, yeah, you know, it could feel so easily just in a modern lens be like, oh, well, why isn't everything just the like Minority Report, you know, like screens, floating screens, iPads or whatever, you know, we'd see that you're actually being in the realistic sense. But it's like, it's great. And I wouldn't want it any other way. It captures the fact that they're all smoking, you know, cigarettes.
Yeah.
You kind of just go, oh, this is the 70s. but at the same time, it's like, no, this is the future in this world. And this world is so good. And I wouldn't want it any other way. And I love being here. It's perfect.
I mean, there's a million things that you could talk about with this movie, but the quintessentialness of having Ripley in it's the second act. It's like once we know the alien exists, she says, why don't we just blow it out the goddamn airlock? And to come back to that actual solution in the end for her, when she's had all these people around her kind of not listening and getting in the way, obviously there's Ash, you know, he's got an agenda and all that, but to have the catharsis as a viewer to see the person who said, look, there's a simple solution to this, let's just do it, to actually fulfill that solution is, I mean, that's what you want. You want to feel that catharsis at the end. Either that or you want complete, like, you know, unfulfilled despair. But that's not this movie, right? Like in this movie, we want her to win. And she does. It's great. And then she's set adrift, so.
So for all the sequels to come.
That's right.
And prequels.
Let's just not think about what happens later.
Yeah, no kidding.
I have a little bit of trivia. I really love learning about how things were done. So apparently shredded condoms were used to create tendons of the beast's ferocious jaws. And the slime used on the alien was KY jelly. Sir Ridley Scott did all the handheld camera work himself.
Mm, that's cool.
And H.R. Giger's original illustrations that inspired the look of the alien, in those illustrations, the creature had eyes. For the movie, Giger insisted that the creature have no eyes, thus giving the bleak appearance of a cold and emotionless beast that hunts by smell. And we do this thing, the questions. So I was wondering, we usually have a metric that applies to the movie itself. So any ideas, Mac, how we could rate this one?
Chest bursters.
So out of five, how would we rate Alien?
Oh my God. A million chest bursters.
It was funny. I actually had a hard time last night where it's like, I watched it last night, my letterbox, and like gave it 5 stars. I had given it that already. I'm like, of course, it's one of those movies. It is a 5-star chest burster, five chest burster film for me through and through. But it's like, at the same time, for my rating system, it's like, I can have 5 chest burster, 5-star films, but I feel like I want to give them 4.5 at the same time, just to be like, okay, but there's other ones that are more favorite of mine. So I was feeling that a little bit with this one, but still landed on 5. But it's like, I don't know, like Poltergeist, it's another 5-star film for me, but it's like, I think I love The Shining and The Exorcist more. So how do I denote that unless I have to make it, you know, unless I make it 4.5 stars is the way to do that. But I hate doing that. I don't know. So it is a 5 chestburster film.
But I have the same,
yeah.
I have the same like thoughts that run into my head, especially when I then compare and I'm like, well, if this was 4 stars, this has to be like 3.5. I always think in my head, if there's absolutely nothing I would change at all, then 5 stars. But if I can think of even one thing, got to bump that down 4.5.
See, yeah, it all depends on the rating system because for me, it's that's not enough for a 5-star. It's like, I wouldn't change anything about Alien. Of course, it is a perfect movie, 5 chestbursters. But aren't there movies that are still like technically my top 10? You know, I don't know. So it's hard. It's always the wavering metric, what that even means for me. Yeah.
I would give it 5 chestbursters too. I do think it's perfect. And Tim, you had mentioned The Thing. I think that's a 5.
Yeah.
5 for sure.
5 dog. I don't know what we. I don't know. We didn't do anything for The Thing, but
5 things.
Five things. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that we could change about it.
No, I wouldn't want to ever. It's perfect.
I was just telling my girlfriend yesterday, like we saw a picture of Sigourney Weaver in front of a hot dog stand from like 1982 or something like that. And she's like, oh, there she is. There's your fave. And I was like, she is. She is my fave. And she's like, I have met many, many celebrities in my life. And, you know, it's not really a thing. I don't, you know, get starstruck. I would be overwhelmingly compelled to go up to her and be like, you're the greatest of all time.
I hope you get to someday. That's great.
It'd be amazing.
Tim, do you have a favorite scene or a favorite kill?
I think the Harry Dean Stanton searching for Jonesy, which is the first kill, right? Well,
after John Hurt, right?
The first adult-sized alien kill. That is, there's something about. You know, I think actually why I like it the most is, this is super weird. I don't know if I've ever told you this. When I was a teenager, we had a CD-ROM. You remember CD-ROMs?
I do.
Do you know what those are, Mac?
Yeah.
I know what CD-ROMs are.
It was a collection of the greatest scenes from cinema. And that scene of him looking for Jonesy was the alien scene. And I watched that scene because I didn't have a copy of the movie. So I just watched this 4-minute scene or whatever it is over and over again from that CD-ROM. So like, it still just like is the one for me. There's something about the dripping of the, you know, like the space itself is amazing.
The sound of the raindrops on his cap.
Yeah, so good.
Or rain, sorry, the pipe, Spike's leaking. Yeah, right. Always feels like rain.
But. Yeah, it does. It feels like rain. So there's something like elemental about it. It's great. I mean, I just love like the whole, because we know he's screwed.
Yeah.
So it's just such a well set up thing. And you're, you know, the beauty of the shot of Jonesy hissing and then being like calm and staring essentially past camera is just amazing.
Yeah, talking about realism, animal actors, good animal actor performance puts you right into it.
That's
and
a great
also
cat.
That scene, I got a shout out, contains what for me, and I'd like to think a lot of others, is a famous horror earworm, which is actually included in our intro.
That's right.
Audio montage is Harry Dean Stanton, his meow.
Meow, meow.
Yeah, it's like... I remember my friends and I, when we were kids, loving this movie. We just loved his delivery and the way he did that meow. So when we had a short list of famous horror earworms to include, that was definitely one of them in our intro. Yeah.
We also like to ask who wins the You Fool Award. So when you're like shouting at the screen, You Fool!
Tom Skerritt
takes it. Mm. Yeah,
yeah,
Tom
Skerritt. Yeah. It's just such a bummer. It's like, dude, he's right. I mean, the movie is literally having everybody yell, like, "No, the other way." So yeah,
yeah. He does try to get out of there though. So you know, he says that to himself. I feel like Harry Dean Stanton, the first one, especially watching it this time, where. Like they say, okay, where they kind of let him go, oh, you go get the cat now. It's like, what are they doing? Why don't they all go together?
But also remember, they think it's a tiny alien at that point.
True.
That is true.
Once they know it's big.
Their question though, then specifically, that's perfect because it's from the audience perspective. We're yelling, you
That's
fool.
True.
Yeah.
We also like to do, what did Letterboxd have to say? But to save time, I just chose 1-star reviews or 1/2-star reviews.
Fair.
And these made me laugh. So Sean gave it 1/2-star. This was a rewatch for Sean. He said, never ever liked this movie. And IDK, if it's a classic, I would literally rather go to work instead of watching this shit.
Be my guest, sir. Go to work.
Christian Mother gave it 1/2-star. Liberal communist agenda.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta be.
Toy Food gave it 1/2-star. I hate this movie so much, I'd rather watch the videos my little brother watches about space where the planets sing and shit.
Wow.
Which are 2 stars.
And, Jules Scott 1 gave it 1-star. Where's the biohazard protocols, SMH?
That's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It's so funny to think that there's, you know, there's a whole population of people who watch this and go, ugh.
Yeah, can you imagine them getting them all together for a screening of this film and just like, boo.
Oh, right. Well, should we turn to Carnival of Souls? I know that this was a Dismembering Horror episode 99, which I listened to, and it was awesome. So I invite people to check that out. But the plot summary from IMDb is, after a traumatic accident, a woman becomes drawn to a mysterious abandoned carnival.
Yeah.
Simple.
I could call her an organist. Gets a little more color in there. Yeah.
So, Ryan, what's your history with this film?
I mean, specifically the history. I remember seeing it. God, I have a pretty good memory, but not for like when things happened. But somewhere in my like high school to mid 20s era, I remember watching this late at night and just not being like crazy about it or anything, but definitely having its spell affect me and sticking with me. So when I think of it, you know, see it pop up on lists over the years, you're like, oh yeah, that was pretty cool. I should watch that again. And then when I finally did, I think it was just before, not just before, but you know, a few years before our podcast. It's kind of like what I said about Midsommar earlier. It just sort of grew to love it more and more and seeing all that there was to it. And then our podcast, when we did that, episode 99, I think it was just since that was right before our retrospective, I don't think it made my top 10, but like now that's sacrilege to me to think I wouldn't put it in there. But at the same time, as I was saying earlier, that speaks to how much I love it, that sometimes the best films, they have that delayed effect. So yeah, that's my history with it. And now, as I said, it's one that I feel compelled to watch every spooky season, or most spooky seasons.
Mac, was this a first time watch for you?
Yeah, first time watching, and first, I'd never heard of it before. But also, I don't watch a lot of, I honestly haven't watched a lot of older movies, so that's not that surprising. Mm.
And I just saw it on a list somewhere, and so I watched it a few months ago, and so now I've seen it about four times since then. Nice. I really love it, yeah.
Good, good. Really good to hear.
Yeah, so for people who are unfamiliar, what would you say about this film, Ryan?
I guess, yeah, about what I love about it. That's what you mean. Like, oh, yeah, and what I said earlier, how in non-genre terms, you know, I can kind of better answer what my favorite horror films are. And they're the ones where there's some sort of some is greater than its parts effect that gives a sense of mood and atmosphere, and often sort of messes with our sense of reality on some level, whether that's just sort of putting us in the dream of the movie. And I don't know. I mean, you say all good movies, all good filmmaking are, yeah, some greater than its parts when it's really working. But something about when, like, that specifically adds up to a spell that the movie is casting, I think, especially just wins me over and I'm fascinated with. And so when you have a horror film that's doing it on this level of, you know, by the end of the movie, just our sense of what is real, what's not, what is she in the afterlife? Is she not? Are the people that she's interacting with some in the afterlife or not with her? Just brings up all these questions that, but with just enough to sort of chew on without any obvious answers, which is important to me too, for getting at that sort of deeply, ooh, it's touching on something real but unknowable. That thing that, you know, David Lynch does so well. This movie is doing that for me. It's getting at something really, really deep that I think like only movies can do about our reality and sort of the spaces in between, for lack of a better way to put it. Because we can't put it anyway, and that's what I love so much about it. So in this film, it does that with, yeah, not just that story, but there's a dissonance is the word I kept thinking of when I was watching it this last time, where like some being greater than its parts. I think it gets even like it gets bonus points for me when that feels like it was circumstances that were like beyond the control of the filmmaker too, that added up to this greater effect it's having, where it just feels like when a movie has serendipity on its side, it's just that so much more exciting. So like the opening moments, you have this really, yeah, it's just kind of, yeah, it feels dissonant. This, the quality of it's like clearly voiceover ADR when the teenagers, the boys are, want to drag race with them, with the girls. And, yeah, it's just like, this is dubbed quality, but then her response is immediately like super on set, can barely understand it. Like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Whatever she says. And it's just like from, you may not notice that unless you're really particular to these details, but it doesn't matter. It still, it just immediately gives you this sort of, yeah, this dissonance. And that just happens throughout the whole movie and in all sorts of ways. So it's so exciting for me. Yeah. Just when the independent level is which it was made helped to add up to this effect, and in the intentional way too, of just, all the intentional filmmaking aspects, as well as those little magic things that are just that much more exciting for me when a movie can not pull those off, but when they happen, it like feels like it's helps justify a movie's existence, but like it
validating.
it's that much more. It gets that much more deep somehow, it feels like, when you have magic on its side like that. And there's the way the whole movie makes you feel like you're going crazy with like, God, like, I mean, the dude that's just like leeching on her, leching on her, both words feel right. The whole film, it's like that shot where, do it to you, Tim. It's like basically just doing that the whole film. And they're just like trying to talk to each other. And it's like all you can look at.
Well, everyone is just a little bit off to me. I mean, everyone just sort of, I mean, that guy for sure, he's just way too like aggressive, but we've met guys like that. So, I mean, in a way he's almost the most realistic, but like the minister guy and the boarding house lady and just everyone is just a little bit off to me.
Yeah, exactly. Like this time watching it, I don't know, did you guys get the feel at all that the boarding house lady feels like she's kind of like hitting on her a little bit or like, I don't know. There's a weird, she's a little excited to have her there. I don't know.
Yes.
It's funny. And then like two comes to mind, like what you're saying, the guy at the drinking fountain, when she's caught up in one of her wandering stupors, he just, mm-hmm. he just has this immediate presence. Like there shouldn't be anything wrong or intimidating about him, but he just feels like so intimidating right now somehow and wrong in this moment. It's incredible.
That organ music too. I mean, I know there's the whole time where she goes buck wild on the keys, but like before then, I mean, maybe it's just me, but like everybody in that church was like, oh, what lovely music. And I was thinking like, this is sounds scary. Like I would hate to the fact that they had to ship this woman out. Like, please play the organ for us. And it's like, that's what it sounds like.
It's intense. Yeah, I kept thinking of the organ playing this time. I mean, not only is it great for the soundtrack, but I'm just trying to like break down like what emotions the organ specifically eliciting. They're big emotions is all I was really thinking about. There's a swelling to it that I think, I don't know, yeah, it matches well with the sort of the heavy religiosity of it all, of just when the priest and it seems like his, and I know it would be his wife, the minister has wife. Yeah. But when they're standing together, just like, ah, beautiful.
This
God is great. You know, there's just something heavy to it. I don't know. Like, yeah. There's something about the organ. It's just big. It just allows you to go there.
I like to look up different phobias and I tried to see if there was a phobia for pipe organs.
Whoa.
And I couldn't find one, but there is a phobia of big things.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think it's megalophobia. So just, and that organ is so big,
mm-hmm.
That it is sort of overwhelming. But I love the scene where she takes, you know, she's barefoot and she's just sort of, you know, exploring the whole keyboard and she really seems to be letting go. And then the minister's like, get out. Like, you can't play music like that in here. And there's this whole thing in the movie where she doesn't fit in with, you know, with the rest of the people in some way or another.
I love all of, I feel like I like related to her so much. Like, I don't know. I feel like I could compare, I don't know, just like her attitude. Cause obviously it's bizarre that, you know, supposedly her friends, you know, drowned and died and she supposedly should have. And she's showing no like outward emotion about it to anybody. But that to me is actually incredibly sounds accurate to somebody who would go through something extremely traumatic like that. And the fact that she just was like, no, let me just get away from here. And then, as you said, Mom, like she now doesn't seem to fit in anywhere and nobody really gets her. And I mean, obviously the guy creeping on her is an obvious creep, but I mean, she isn't really acting very normally in response to him either. Like she is kind of erratic with her like one day, you know, she's like, you know what, get out of my room. And the next day she's like, well, it's perfect that you're here. And it just seems like she's really lost and has no idea. She doesn't have any idea what's going on with herself, but that rang very true to me. I feel like the way she played it, it just is like we all have a lot of stuff, big stuff going on inside. And I feel like when you're focusing on that and trying to keep it all in, you do act weird to the people around you. And I felt a lot of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the film, it's aware of that too. Like, I feel like the theme stated moment is it, I think it's the preacher priest. He says to her, you know, you can't just live in isolation from the world. That can, you know, mean a lot of things. But it really struck me this time around. And yeah, that's her response to all that. Oh my God. It's like, yeah, so perfect where it feels so just like cold, but you get it when she's saying goodbye, or the organist is saying, the guy at the organist factory is saying goodbye to her at the beginning. And he's like, well, do stop by next time you're in town. And she's like, I'm never coming back. And no further goodbye. No, it's been nice knowing you. But just it's there's just something heavy about that when it's like, oh, she's literally, we're never, like, if, you know, from the perspective of that guy, we're never going to see her again in my whole life. And she hardly said goodbye. There she goes. Great. All right.
Does she talk to a psychiatrist or something also and say, like, I don't find it easy to connect to people, or there's a conversation like that in there too, where she seems very self-aware.
Yeah.
That she's like, I have difficulty making connections with people. You do get the feeling that there's some disconnect here, and I don't know how to bridge that, you know? And yeah. So I'm glad that a woman's telling the story.
Maybe this is some of that disconnect. I don't know, but it's great. And I love this idea. I'm making a movie now where I'm trying to do this, where the horror plays on that sort of balance of like your own vulnerability in situations like that, where like, yeah, you can say she's talking to the psychologist, psychiatrist. The second scene with him after we've already set up, you know, really obviously, but in that fun way, it works at the same time too, where, his back, the back of the chair is facing her. Feels like maybe there she is starting to open up a little bit. And then like, when you think, well, what is the actual like fear of doing that? But to have a film manifest that fear by then, as soon as she opens up that little bit, the man, as he's called, is the one in the chair, the ghoul, whatever you want to call him, almost as a response to letting herself open that little bit, has then made herself available to be more receptive to that evil. It's so good. It's just like, yeah, way to capture like whatever that ineffable fear is that should be about nothing, but it is clearly about something.
I was talking to Mac before you guys got on. I really like this guy's face. I just love it so much. And to me, he didn't look that scary. Just because, I mean, I just think underneath he just looks so sweet. Mm-hmm. But I know, you know, with the makeup and everything, it's supposed to be scary. But I just found the John Linden guy just so much scarier to me. Mm-hmm. And I just loved it at the end when she's wearing the makeup and, you know, we understand what's finally going on, I guess. How did you guys feel about the man?
Oh, man.
Oh, I mean, I love that. There's something creepier to me about it when it's like it's kind of like in the vein of the new movie Smile. I haven't seen it, but just that effect too, where if someone's friendly appears so in that way, it makes a sinisterness feel all that much more sinister. What are their aims here? I think it is just an extra level of that kind of dissonance. And I think people often like that. Like, I can imagine being a little kid and he's my uncle or something, and like him trying to scare me and him being like my favorite, sweetest uncle. But at the same time, when it's he's trying to scare me after a scary movie, it being like especially scary, because then all of a sudden someone who is, you know, is just radiates niceness and joy, they can sort of almost go that far inversely. If that makes sense, you know, I love you to, I'm going to get you. It's just like one extreme to the other. So it works for me, creeps me out for sure. I love his look in it.
Did we ever talk when we did this? Did we relate this to Beetlejuice at all? I can't remember.
No. Wow. The ghoul, I guess. Yeah.
Well, there's a few things, right? Like her crashing and dying off the bridge. Mm-hmm. Well, dying, mm-hmm. so to speak. And yeah. then this sort of, this go-between of realms, right? Yeah. This sort of like the disparity between, well, we're here, but we're not really here, or are we? And like, I wonder if there, this movie served as some inspiration for that.
Both have the dance scenes too.
Yeah. So there's, I wonder, I don't know, just popped into my mind.
Another 5-star favorite of mine.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Oh, that's a great connection. I think probably, right? I mean, there's just too many coincidences.
Even Beetlejuice's makeup itself,
yes, makeup
kind of harkens back to this.
I definitely would not be surprised at all if this was one of Tim Burton's favorites.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like,
or it's just a thing.
Yeah, everything is in everything. So,
right.
Yeah.
I really liked all the reflections, like when she sees herself in the car window and then the man appears all of a sudden and then she sees herself again, and I don't know, it's just like in the very beginning I'm sure she's like, did I even see that, like what's happening? But I just really love all those reflections. I thought that was such a cool effect.
Yeah, it's so simple too. Yeah, it's so effective. Yeah.
And like I said, I did watch the Twilight Zone episode that this was based on, and just going back to the man, the hitchhiker in that show, you guys can look him up, but he's got just the sweetest face.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But the actor is so great because he's just like super slow with his movements, and he's just like very, very creepy. And the actress who's working off of him is also, you know, displaying a lot of fear. So it really works. It's great. Well, I did find some trivia on this one. The damage to the bridge in the opening scene of the film cost Herc Harvey $12. the town of Lee Compton, Kansas, only required the railing of the bridge to be replaced to grant permission to film there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the little commentary on the Criterion Channel with the writer and director, and apparently it was all fine as long as they could get the car, you know, out of the river. They were fine to crash it. And I guess he said it was like within a half hour, you know, the car was back on the road. So it seems like there was just a lot of grace, you know, surrounding this production.
Yeah. Which, you know, that's, yeah, exactly. That's what, this is a good word for it, but yeah, that's what I was trying to get at earlier with serendipity, which, recently I was just thinking about how fun and reassuring that can be when that happens with specifically horror films, making horror films, because when you're making horror films involved with them, like, you know, there's that series on Shudder, Curse Films, it almost feels like you're tempting fate a little bit by connecting to something, you know, outside forces or whatever, you know, those films kind of get at the allure of that. I was just in rural Missouri working on some friends' horror film that they made, a found footage horror film, all about like opening a portal to hell. And it was eerie. The movie is eerie. It's good. I like it. But, you know, I went and saw the portal of hell that they painted for it and all that. And I'm just like, just couldn't help but thinking all along. And my mom said that to me when I checked up with her and called her. She's like, anything weird happen? You're all okay? kind of thing. Nice supportive things can happen under the context of a horror movie. It feels like it's that little, bit of grace saying it's like, no, horror has value too. Yeah, things are a little spooky, weird, but maybe one can be respectful of that and get a helping hand to go to this place safely and not be tempting fate too bad. So this film feels like, one of those for me, as I've said.
Let's see. I have... the shots from the ghouls rising from the Salt Lake were actually filmed in an apartment complex swimming pool near director Harvey's house, Florence, Kansas. And the film inspired Soul Survivor from 1984, which in turn is said to have inspired Final Destination. Have you guys seen Soul Survivor?
No, but it literally just came up because Tim and I were... Well, yeah, that was with you, right? Where I was trying to look up the spelling of soul, or was that by myself?
No, that was with me.
Okay, where I'm like, when it's the term soul, and I just thought of the phrase soul survivor, I'm like, okay, that's a way to, that's the meaning that I want here. Okay, it is S-O-L-E. Okay, great. So it was just weird. The first time I'd ever heard of that movie was just recently, and you just mentioned it now. Anyways.
Yeah, I think it's on Shudder. I just watched it myself, coincidentally, and... The shot, the still for the movie is great because it's she's the sole survivor of a plane crash, and she's like sitting in the center seat of like, you know, her airplane seat, you know, with this like stunned look on her face. So yeah, it's got some interesting takes in it. I guess I'd recommend it.
I'm acquaintances with Jeffrey Reddick, who was the writer on Final Destination. I should reach out to him and ask him about his experience with these movies.
Soul Survivor, then Carnival of Souls. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
how much of this were you pulling from? That'd be cool to know.
You asked about Halloween traditions. I do like to watch through a full franchise. I try to each October. So this made me think of it. Last year I did all the Final Destinations.
Oh, fun. Wow. Yeah. I think I only got through maybe three or four. Is it worth it to go through them all?
If you're a completionist like me, I mean, I wanted to see it through. I can't, I mean, yeah, you get more of the same. I forget my ranking. I meant to rank them. I don't know. Maybe I didn't. Anyways, I don't know.
Here are some one-star reviews from Letterboxd that made me laugh. Carrie, with a question mark, gave it a half star. Move to Utah to play the organ. What's next? Move to Oregon to play the Utah?
All right.
Wow.
YSL Nacho gave it a half star. Poor lady gets chased by Marilyn Manson and continually and creepily hit on by an absolute college Chad and perv who can't take no for an answer. Awful.
I mean, that sounds great.
Angie gave it one star. Do all the movies that I've been watching lately suck? Or is it because I live in Massachusetts?
I wish we could tell you, Angie.
Ashley gave it one star. This movie was art, and as is the case with most art, I did not get it.
All right.
Cody gave it one star. If you like bad acting, unmotivated dialogue, awkward editing, contrived plot points, boring scares, and a will they, won't they with a creepy pervert, then Carnival of Souls is the film for you.
Mm. Always curious what their favorite films are when you see reviews that are horrible for kids you love.
Yeah, right.
I should add that to our feature there because often with these reviews, we're just like, obviously the person just completely didn't get it, or they're doing some kind of like performance art with their Letterboxd account or something's going on.
Right.
But guys, how would we rate this? Not sure what our metric should be. Maybe church organs.
Great.
But how many would we give this movie?
I mean, this sits at a 5 out of 5 for me. It's doing that ineffable thing I said I love so much. I get put in a weird fugue state when I see it. And the fact that a movie can do that to me in this specific way that only this movie really. There's other movies that do that generally, but this, you know, each one does its own specific flavor of that. And this fully does that. So yeah, 5 organs for me for sure.
I think I'm still just beneath that. Like I would be a 4 organ person for this one. It's not that I don't love it, but it's sort of just not my style, I guess. Although the more you watch it, obviously you start picking up things like you mentioning the sound being weird in the beginning. The first time I watched it, I was like, you know, groaning because I was like, oh, here we go, bad sound. But now that we like you look at it in entirety, you go, wait, was that purposeful to sort of further along the disparity that she is experiencing?
Yeah.
You know, so stuff like that, you start to go, wait a minute, much of this was like a part of the film? How much of it was purposeful? How much of it was happy accident? And I think that's makes for a better, like it makes the film have more longevity in a way, because it's like you're discovering little things.
Yeah.
Each time you watch it. So that's always good.
I think it's exciting when it's like, whether it's intentional or not is almost besides the point. It's like we covered Qui-Gon and I really loved that film. And like we mentioned the sound design for that, how like the sort of hits that are supposed to happen at a certain time that are like just matched to movements or whatever, they come just a little off beat.
Yeah.
So that was clearly intentional, but it's like same effect. Wouldn't be surprised if it's more unintentional, this one.
But it works regardless, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's always good. But I'm a four. Four organ.
What about you, Mac?
I think I'd say four organs as well. It definitely increased through this podcast. Ryan, you made me like the movie a lot more. So now I think I need to watch it again.
Great. I hope, revisit it next Halloween. I hope its spell continues to be cast over you.
Yeah, I'm a five too. Ryan, do you have a favorite scene in the film?
I mean, I guess kind of, you know, what Tim was saying earlier, like when a horror movie can pull off a last act, there's just a kind of beautiful / horrific just revelry or carnivalesque revelry, you know, in the sense of this movie. So just which is when the dance scene is happening, and it's just how that plays out is introduced, and she kind of becomes a part of it too. But there's just this manic energy when it's like the lights come up and they just start doing that circle dancing. It's just oof. I don't know. It gets me. It all builds towards that, and it's really affecting. Yeah.
Does anybody get the You Fool Award on this one?
That creepy guy.
Yeah. Just for being.
Yeah, for existing.
Yeah, I mean, she's the only one. I mean, a kind of just all of them in the car at the beginning. Just,
yeah, don't race, maybe, yeah. Is the biggest takeaway.
And I'm yelling at the guys more, of course. Like, what do you expect? Like, what, you're on a bridge, like, running into them? Like, come on, guys, you fools. So, yeah. You know.
So I just want to say to Ryan and Tim, thank you so much for talking with us today about those films that mean the world of horror to you.
Yeah, happy to spread the good word. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's great.
Well, hosts, thanks for tuning into this mini. Coming up on the main show, it's Mac's pick of genre, and he has chosen early creature features with interesting application of effects. We will be looking at Yokai 100 Monsters from Japan and The Creeping Flesh from the UK. Ooh. Thanks again to Tim and Ryan from Dismembering Horror for joining us. Is there anything that you'd like to plug or promote, guys?
Just our show. And I think Dismembering Horror got a lot of episodes. And I think specifically, hope I speak for both of us. I'm excited. We're kind of transitioning to making it more of a video show, or at least have that goal in mind for next year. So slowly uploading our episodes to YouTube day by day. And I want to move over to a video version of the show that could sort of play to our filmmaking interests a little more. So I guess like and subscribe on that. So that's what they say.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, stay tuned. We'll have more stuff.
Remember, Wohos, we love you. And don't go into the basement.